This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents That Month in Tuscany by Inglath Cooper. Performed by Terry Clark Linden, Eric G. Dove, Adam Werner, and Lauren Ezzo. One. Lizzie. If I'm honest with myself, truly honest, I will admit I knew that in the end he wouldn't go. But to leave it until the night before, that surprises even me. Here I sit on my overpacked suitcase in the foyer of this too large house I've spent the past 5 years decorating and fussing over, picking out paint colors and rugs, which include the exact same shade, and art that can only be hung on the walls if it looks like an original, even if it isn't. I stare at the pair of tickets in my hand, open the folder and read the schedule as I have a dozen times before. Departure, Charlotte, North Carolina, 3:45 p.m. Arrival, Rome, Italy, 7:30 a.m. Departure, Rome, Italy, 9:40 a.m. Arrival, Florence, Italy, 10:45 a.m. My name is on one, Millicent Elizabeth Harper. His on the other, Tyler Fraser Harper. I bought the ticket 6 months ago. Plenty of time to plan how to get away from the office for a month. Make whatever arrangements had to be made. Didn't people do things like that now and then? Check out of their real lives for a bit? Let others take over in their absence? Tyler's response would be, yeah, people who don't care about their careers. People who don't mind risking everything they've worked for by letting some Ivy League know-it-all step into their shoes long enough to prove that they can fill them. Our 20th anniversary is tomorrow. I'd imagined that we would arrive at the Hotel Savoy and celebrate with a bottle of Italian champagne in a room where we could spend the next month getting to know one another again, the way we had once known one another, traveling around the Tuscan countryside on day trips and eating lunch in small-town trattorias, exploring art museums and local artisan shops. I shared all of this with him, and he had done a fine job of making me believe that he found it as appealing as I did. It felt as if we again had a common interest after years of a life divided into his and hers, yours and mine. Then, a little over a week ago, he'd begun to plant the seeds of backpedaling. I had just finished putting together a salad for our dinner when my cell phone rang. It lay buzzing on the kitchen counter. And something in my stomach, even at that moment, told me that he would back out. I started not to answer, as if that would change the course of the demolition he was about to execute on the trip I had been dreaming of our entire married life. Actually, maybe the trip was a metaphor for what I had hoped would be the resurrection of our marriage during a month away together. The two of us, Ty and me, like it used to be when we first started dating. And it didn't matter what we were doing as long as we did it together. Ironically, we've had the house to ourselves for almost 2 years now. It's hard to believe that Kylie's been away at college for that long, but she has. Almost 2 years during which I've continued to wait for Ty's promises of less time at the office and more time at home to actually bear fruit. Only they never have. And I guess this is what it has taken to make me see that they never will. Me, sitting on a suitcase, alone in our house, waiting for something that's not going to happen. Waiting for Ty to realize that we hardly even know each other anymore. Waiting for him to remember how much he had once loved me. Waiting for him to miss me. I feel my phone vibrate in the pocket of my jacket. I know without looking that it's Ty. Calling to make sure I've canceled our tickets and gotten as much of a refund as I can, considering that it's last minute. I know that he'll also want to make sure I'm back to my cheerful self. He'll be waiting for the note of impending forgiveness in my voice, the one that tells him he doesn't need to feel guilty. I'll be here, as I always have. Things happen, plans get changed. Buck up and move on. I pull the phone from my pocket, stare at his name on the screen. I lift my thumb to tap answer. I'm poised to do every one of the things that Ty expects of me. I really am. Then I picture myself alone in this house every day from 6:30 to 8 o'clock at night. And I just can't stand the thought of it. I actually feel physically ill. I realize in that moment that I am at a crossroad. Stay and lose myself forever to someone I had never imagined I would be. Go, and maybe, maybe, start to resurrect the real me. Or find out if she is actually gone forever. The moment hangs. My stomach drops under the weight of my decision. I hit end call and put the phone back in my pocket. And without looking back, I pick up my suitcase and walk out the door. I park in the long-term lot and not in the back either, where Ty would insist that I leave the BMW. I park it smack dab up front, tight, in between a well-dented minivan and a Ford Taurus with peeling paint. It is the very last parking space Ty would pick, and petty as it sounds, I get enormous pleasure from the fact that my door has to touch the other vehicle in order for me to squeeze out. I get my suitcase out of the trunk, letting it drop to the pavement with a hard thunk. I roll it to the white airport shuttle waiting at the curb. An older man with a kind face gets out and takes my bag from me, lifting it up the stairs with enough effort that I wish he'd let me do it myself. Then he smiles at me, and I realize he doesn't mind. There are two people already on the shuttle, sitting in the back. They are absorbed in each other, the woman laughing at something the man has said. I deliberately don't look at them, keeping my gaze focused over the shoulder of the driver who is now whistling softly.
"What gate, ma'am?" he asks, looking up at me in the rearview mirror.
"United," I answer.
"You got it," he says and goes back to his whistling.
I feel my phone vibrating in the pocket of my black coat. I try to resist the urge to look at who's calling, but my hand reaches for it automatically. "Ty." It's the third time he's called since I left the house. I put the phone back in my pocket. When we arrive at the United Gate, the whistling driver again helps me with my suitcase. I drop a tip in the cup by the door and thank him.
"You're most welcome, dear. Where are you headed?"
"Italy," I say. He lifts his eyebrows and says,
"I always wanted to see that place. You going by yourself?"
"Yes," I answer. It's only then that I'm absolutely sure I am really doing this. I am doing this. The check-in process is lengthy. When the woman behind the desk asks me about my husband's ticket, I tell her that he will be along shortly. Lying isn't something I'm in the habit of doing, but I don't think I can admit to her that he isn't coming without unraveling an explanation that might keep us both here way past the plane's departure time.
"Hopefully he'll be here soon," she says. "Don't want to cut it too close. These international flights leave promptly."
I simply nod. She asks to see my passport, compares the picture with my face, and types a whole bunch of things into the computer. What, I cannot imagine, because they already have all my information. A full 5 minutes tick by before she hands me the boarding pass. Taking it from her feels like the closing of a door that I will not be able to reopen. As metaphors go, I have to think it's pretty accurate. The security process is almost reason enough for me to stop flying altogether. If I could get to Italy by car, I would most certainly drive. The underwire in my bra instigates a pat-down by a woman who looks as if she's no happier about the procedure than I am. She asks me in a cigarette-roughened voice if I would rather have this conducted in a private room. Since I suppose that means she and I would be the only two occupants, I choose public embarrassment instead. Once my bra passes the feel-up check, I am directed through the booth where I have to spread my legs and raise my arms in the same posture criminals are told to take by their arresting officer. Not for the first time, I resent the heck out of the bad people who caused all of us trying hard to be good ones to have to go through this. An oversized purse is my only carry-on, and once my laptop and camera come through the conveyor belt, I stick them back inside. I head for the concourse that my plane will be leaving from. Boarding begins in less than an hour, so I buy a few snacks and use the ladies' room. I find a seat in the chairs by the gate. It looks as if the flight will be full, based on the number of people already here. The thought of an overbooked, way too full flight makes my stomach drop. I cannot remember the last time I went anywhere by myself. I'm used to Ty carrying the tickets, checking in the luggage while Kylie and I hover in the background, handing over our identification when prompted and checking email on our phones. I pull out my phone now and glance at the screen, noticing a text message. I click in and see that it's from Wynn. Lizzie, you and Ty have the time of your lives. I cannot, capital letters, wait to hear all about it. I just know you two are going to come back like newlyweds. Shoot, Ty might even leave the firm, and y'all can travel around indefinitely the way you always dreamed about. The message blurs before my eyes, the tears there before I can even think to will them away. I tap in a response. Ty's not going. I hit send, and it seems as if the reply is nearly instantaneous. What? Question mark, double exclamation point, question mark. The phone vibrates. Wynn's name pops up on the screen. I hit answer and put it to my ear. Yes, I know. I was a fool to think he really would. Lizzie! My name is drawn out into at least six syllables. I hear her devastation. It's nearly as thick and heartbroken as my own. What? Why? A new case, I say. Are you kidding me? She asks, the question lit with instant fury. While there's really nothing to be gained from it, it kind of feels nice to have someone see things from my point of view. I can't believe he would do this to you. It's your 20th anniversary. Yes, I say. It is. He doesn't deserve you, Lizzie. He never did. You're just saying that because you're mad. No one wanted us to be together more than you. Well, I was wrong. I'm a big enough person to admit that. I almost smile at this. Ty has never had a bigger fan than Wynn. In fact, I think she's been a little secretly in love with him since the day we both met him in English Lit at UVA. And what do you mean? She asks suddenly. Ty is not going. Are you going? I glance around at the other passengers, and the whole thing feels surreal, like a dream I'm going to wake up from at any moment. Yes, I say again, making my decision reality. At least 3 seconds of silence tick by before she says, Wow. You think I'm crazy. I think you're right. It's exactly what you should do, but I can't believe you're actually going to. There's something in there that should make me feel less than good. You know what I mean. How many times has he done this to you? That trip to the Caribbean after our 10-year reunion? The ski trip last winter? I know, I say, stopping her. I don't need to hear the list of times Ty has disappointed me. Because if I do, I'm also going to remember that I've pretty much been a doormat for him to wipe his feet on. I wish I could go with you, Wynn says. Are you staying the whole month? That's my plan. And then as if she remembers the reason I'm going alone, she says, I'm really sorry, Lizzie. You don't deserve this. You deserve so much better. Spilled milk and all that, I say. It's his loss. One day he's going to realize that. What did he say when you said you were going without him? He doesn't know yet. Again, silence,
processing, and then, "Are you sure this is Lizzie Harper?"
I actually laugh at this. "I am incredulous. It's what you should have done a long time ago, you know," she says softly. "Probably no denying that.
He needs a good wake-up call."
"You know, Wynn, it's not even about that. I'm doing this for me."
"Good. Good," she repeats. "How do I get in touch with you?"
"Once I leave the States, my phone will be useless. I didn't sign up for the international plan because I thought it would be nice for the two of us to cut off all communications from home for the time we were there. Ironic, isn't it?"
"But how will I know how you're doing?"
"I'll check in by email, if I have wireless."
"You promise?"
"I promise."
"I love you, Lizzie. I'm proud of you."
"You're just saying that because I'm so pathetic."
"Pathetic would be you canceling the trip."
"Yeah?"
"Yeah. And don't spend all your time walking through museums and old churches and stuff. Find something fun to do. Someone fun to win."
She laughs.
"It would serve him right."
"You know that's not me."
"Maybe it should be you.
Like that would fix my life."
"Might not fix your life, but it would definitely fix the moment."
I smile and shake my head.
"You'd make a terrible shrink."
"But an excellent friend."
"I'll give you that. Roanoke won't be the same without you."
"It's only a month."
"Let me hear from you."
"I will," I say, adding,
"Be good. Only if you promise not to be."
2. Ty. "You think you know someone. Really know them. Inside and out. That's what being married for 20 years does. You know what your spouse is thinking nearly before she does. Except, not this time. This time, you have no idea what to make of this out-of-character response to not getting her way. You think of all the times in the past when things hadn't worked out as originally planned, of how she'd taken it in stride, understood your work schedule, the competitive nature of your work, and how important it was to stay ahead of the pack, to lead or be trampled. Okay, so maybe you weren't completely honest with her about the new caseload, how critical it is for you to be in the office during the next few weeks, how the timing could not have been worse. But would she have understood? No, and so you really had no choice but to leave it until the last minute. Outside of your closed office door, you hear the voices of assistants and attorneys, the buzz of Finley, Harkington, and Crass cases being built, others being taken apart, and you realize that you have no desire to be anywhere other than here. This is what fills your tank. You don't need a trip to Italy. You have no desire to see any other part of the world than the one you live in each day, thrive in each day. You love this world and your vital role in it. Not so for Lizzie. But then she's not a part of your world. You're aware that you've put your own needs, your own likes and dislikes above hers, but you're the breadwinner of the family. And shouldn't that count for something? Shouldn't your desire to stay on top of your career take precedence over touring a country you'll never see again once you leave there? A country full of old, crumbling buildings and modern cars, trying to make use of archaic cobblestone streets? You pick up the iPhone and tap redial for the 10th time in the last few minutes. But she's not answering her phone, and you find this truly amazing. Damn it, you paid for the thing. The least you could do is answer it. You feel the heat creep up your neck, settled at the line of your starched shirt collar, as if it has hit a seawall. You lean back in the chair, closing your eyes and counting to 10. If there's anything you've never been able to tolerate, it's ingratitude. Lizzie has never appreciated the life you've built for her, for Kylie. Always, you felt the unspoken dissatisfaction within her. The sense that the life she lives isn't the one she'd wanted. You married her for crap's sake. You didn't have to. You could have left her high and dry to take care of a baby on her own. Guilt instantly hits you for the thought. You love Kylie as much as Lizzie loves her. You wouldn't trade being her father for anything. But it is true that not every guy would do what you did. The right thing. The honorable thing. And she's never given you credit for that. You wonder now if the reason you'd finally agreed to go on the anniversary trip in the first place was because of that ever-present dissatisfaction you forever sense in Lizzie. Had you ever intended to follow through? You don't really know the answer to that question. Your reason for backing out, however, is a completely legit one. Is it your fault that Lizzie has never understood the word compromise? You open the desk drawer, toss the phone inside just so you aren't tempted to call her again. Let her get over there, see what it's like to be alone without a man by your side. Maybe then she'll finally see what it means to have a husband like you, a protector, a gatekeeper. A knock sounds at the door. You straighten your tie, open your laptop, and pretend to be studying the screen. Come in. She walks to the desk, lays a file on the stack in the corner. I went through the brief as you asked me to, she says, her confident 20-something gaze meeting yours and holding it. You start to look away, but there's a flicker of something in her eyes that prevents you from doing so. Great, you say. I'll look over your notes later this afternoon. If you have any questions, don't hesitate to buzz me, she says. Your gaze drops from her face to the neckline of her light blue sweater. The amount of skin showing is modest. This is a law firm, of course, and she's a new associate. But there's enough skin showing that you know a stab of longing to see if the rest of her is as smooth, as silky. Neither of you say anything. You're processing this surge of attraction you feel for her. She's processing the fact that you're attracted to her. Deciding, perhaps, if the feeling is mutual. You raise your gaze to meet hers, and feel the spurt of victory when you see that it is indeed mutual. The silence clicks in and holds there. You wonder how long it would take for you to get an invitation to her apartment. Not long, you suspect. You are a partner in the firm, after all, and she's definitely interested in climbing the ladder. Although if you had her best interests in mind, you would tell her that she should probably stick to the traditional method for getting ahead in this firm, billing every hour she possibly can. That is the way you get noticed by the senior partners. You should know. But then if you had warned some of the others throughout the years, you would most certainly have missed out on some very memorable times. She breaks the look first, as if she's felt the current of your doubt. She takes a step back, her hand fluttering at the neckline of her sweater. And you let her go. For now.
3. Lizzie. It's truly amazing how much nicer first class is than coach. I've never flown it before, this trip pretty much being the splurge of a lifetime, my lifetime anyway. But an hour into the flight, as I'm sipping champagne and picking at a delicious assortment of olives and nuts, I decide that it is worth every penny. Every penny of Ty's, that is. He's flown first class across the country enough times that it's become no big deal to him. I, on the other hand, am amazed by all the space in front of me and at my sides. The seat next to me, of course, is empty because that is where Ty is supposed to be. I'm offered red wine with my dinner, vegetarian as I had requested. I decide that it's even better than the champagne. By the third refill, I am south of tipsy. The movie I'm watching is far funnier than I remember a review giving it credit for. I should add that I'm not a big drinker. I've always been known as something of a lightweight. Couple glasses of wine and I'm good. My reputation is still accurate. 3 hours into the flight, I'm in the bathroom depositing my vegetarian dinner into the toilet, the nausea hitting me so suddenly that I almost don't make it to the bathroom in time. Once I'm done, I stand in front of the slightly out-of-focus mirror, my hands braced on the sink, staring at my reflection. I look alarming. My face has absolutely no color, my lips nearly as pale. My forehead has that glisten of sweat left in the wake of severe nausea. I close my eyes and will the last wave of it away, certain there's nothing left inside of me to throw up. Once it passes, I wet a paper towel and wipe my face, fill a cup with water and rinse my mouth. Along with my dinner, I have lost every speck of giddiness loaned to me by the champagne and red wine. My head is beginning to throb like a bass beat. If I can make it back to my seat, I think I'll be fine. I just have no idea how I'm going to get there. I take a few moments to gather my courage, then slide the door lock to the vacant position and pull it inward. I start down the aisle and immediately feel as if I'm walking on the deck of a listing ship. Only I'm not sure if it's the floor or me that's listing. I stumble, reaching to catch myself on a seat back, when an arm suddenly shoots out to stop me. I don't fall exactly. It's more like a collapse onto the lap of the person attached to the arm. I squeeze my eyes shut, giving myself 1 second to pray this didn't really happen, but was merely part of my drunken imagination. As soon as I force my eyes open, I see that it's not. Staring back at me, a pair of blue, very blue eyes. To further my humiliation, they appear to be amused. "I am so sorry," I say, willing myself to get up as I say the words, but finding that my legs feel like spaghetti noodles beneath me, and the plane is doing that listing thing again.
"I'm glad the stewardess has already taken away my mostly uneaten chicken tetrazzini," he says. "Otherwise, you would be wearing it on your..."
He doesn't say backside, but then he doesn't need to. "I kind of lost my balance," I say. His eyes light up another notch.
"I noticed you were having a little trouble with that on the way to the bathroom."
My mortification is now at level 10, and the flame of it sets my cheeks on fire. I think if I put my hand to them, they will actually burn me. I'm not a big...
drinker, he finishes for me.
No.
"It didn't seem like you had enough to justify a bolt to the bathroom."
My vision has begun to lose its blurred edges. His face comes into complete focus. It's a rather amazing face. 30-ish. Lean in the way of someone who's very physical. Running, cycling. I start to ask him which one, under the lingering confidence of inebriation. I curb the impulse and clamp my teeth over my tongue, struggling once again to get up. My legs have regained some of their musculature, but at that very moment, the plane jolts hard. A scream pops out of my throat. Before I can stop myself, I am toppling onto his lap once again.
"Ah, that was a big one," he says,
sounding level-headed, when all of a sudden I'm worried. The captain comes on then and says,
"Everyone take your seats, please. Flight attendants, take your seats as well. The seatbelt light will remain on until further notice."
The first class attendant comes striding by, tossing us both a look of slight disbelief, and then,
"If you could please take your seat, ma'am."
"Yes, of course, I'm going," I add, and then manage to get to my feet, forcing myself not to look at the man whose lap I've hijacked. "I'm sorry," I say, "really sorry."
"Sure you're okay?"
he asks. I nod, try for a smile that doesn't happen, and then slink back to my own seat, popping the belt buckle into place. I grab the blanket that I left on the seat beside me, put it over my head, and lean against the window, my stomach rising and falling with every leap and dip of the plane. I tell myself that could not have happened. I don't do things like this. I can't even remember the last time I had too much to drink. It's probably been 15 years or more. With that thought comes another. How long has it been since I sat on the lap of an attractive man who wasn't my husband? Of course, I don't remember the last time I sat on Ty's lap either. But I know I'm not supposed to be feeling this almost painful physical awareness in the pit of my stomach. My victim's seat is across the aisle from mine. There is absolutely no way I can take this blanket off my head until the plane lands in Rome. I lift an edge close to the window so that I can breathe, and then pray that I fall asleep, or even pass out. At this point, that would be okay too. I come awake to the flight attendant announcing our arrival in Rome. Somehow, I've managed to sleep through the remainder of the flight and the actual landing. I remove the blanket from my head, squinting against the onslaught of light. My mouth has that haven't-brushed-your-teeth-in-forever feeling, and I long for a toothbrush. A bell dings, and the sound of seatbelts being unbuckled in unison prompts me to undo my own and stand on somewhat shaky legs. Memory hits me in full assault, just as my gaze lands on the guy across the aisle. He's watching me with those reluctantly amused blue eyes I now remember from the vantage point of his lap. His smile is slightly crooked, and his voice low when he says, "How are you doing?" "Ah, fine," I say in utter denial of the headache pounding against my temples like a conga drum.
"Good,"
he answers. I'm really sorry," I say, hoping I won't be required to finish the sentence.
"Hey," he says, "it was no big deal."
During this exchange, part of me is nodding and looking appreciative, while the other part of me is processing details about him that I wish I could deny being intrigued by. His hair, which I remember noticing last night, even through my drunken fog, is thick and longish. It's dark, the contrast to his eyes a distinct one. Wynne might tag him beautiful male watching. As an art history major, she developed a habit of categorizing the guys we met in college by painting possibilities. She usually nailed them, too. Arrogant guy lying, suspicious guy stalking, and in Ty's case, gorgeous while knowing it. Beautiful male watching breaks the moment by standing, and it is only then that I realize how tall he is. 6'3", anyway, judging the distance he must duck in order to keep from banging his head on the storage bin above his seat. He opens it, reaches up to pull out a backpack, and says over his shoulder,
"Is Rome your final stop?"
"No," I say. "I'm headed to Florence."
"Have you been before?"
"No," I say, reaching beneath the seat to pull out my bag. "Have you?"
"Yeah, it's pretty amazing."
"I can imagine. Have imagined," I say, and then mentally wince at the lameness of my response.
"How long are you planning to be there?"
he asks. I'm struck mute by the question because I suddenly realize that I have no idea. The original plan was for a month, but now that I'm on the other side of the Atlantic, thinking without the confidence-building qualities of champagne, it seems ridiculous that I am here at all. "I'm not really sure yet," I say. He's fully facing me now, and having moved out into the aisle, standing straight, he's as tall as I had originally guessed. There is something about him that seems vaguely familiar in the way of someone I might have seen before, although I think I would have remembered him, married or not. I decide my dehydrated brain is not an accurate barometer of memory, or much of anything else at the moment.
"Where are you staying?"
he asks. I feel the tilt of interest in the question. Or maybe it's only politeness. The part of me that hasn't known that feeling in a very long time threatens to send out banners of gratitude and reciprocal interest. There is weight in the moment, heavy like a pendulum, that might or might not give in to the swing. I decide that his question is merely polite conversation, and the fact that I would consider the possibility that it is anything other than that is a fairly good indicator of my own parched ego. The Hotel Savoy. I say quickly, and on the low side so that he leans in a bit as if to make sure he heard me correctly.
Very nice,
he says.
You'll enjoy it.
The departure shuffle has begun, the people behind us moving forward in small but determined steps. The plane door has been opened, and the rows of passengers at the front begin to file out. I smooth my hand across my hair, aware suddenly that I must look an utter mess. We catch gazes again, the moment hanging there like a possibility that I know cannot exist. It's my turn to file out. I try for a smile and say, well, enjoy your trip, and thanks for your patience. His smile is warmth-inducing. I think I actually feel its effect in my nerve endings.
Not a problem, he says. You take care, okay?
I will, I say, and then leave the plane without looking back, putting my focus on the walkway that leads to the customs terminal. I can't deny a feeling of letdown, as if I'm driving by a scenic overlook to a beautiful place, but have passed the turnoff and have no choice but to keep going. I spot the sign that says baggage claim, Italian above, English below. I head in that direction and notice my reflection in a window. My suspicions of horror are confirmed. My hair looks as if I slept with a blanket over my head. My face is completely devoid of any makeup. My clothes look like I've been wearing them for a week. I repair the damage as best I can and walk to the luggage area. It takes several minutes for me to get there, and when I do, I realize that most of the other passengers on the plane have beaten me to it. It takes forever to get through customs, and when I finally step through and looking for a taxi stand, I hear a young girl's shriek. A chorus of yelps follows hers, and I see what looks like a group of college-age girls circling something, or someone, shouldering into one another. It becomes clear then that they are getting things signed, shoulders, t-shirts, hats. One by one they melt away from the circle, jumping up and down with ear-piercing squeals of delight. Curious, I watch for a couple of minutes longer, until the crowd has thinned enough for me to glimpse what it is that sent them into this frenzy. That's when I see beautiful male watching, pen in hand, signing as quickly and efficiently as he can while being bumped and shouldered into by dozens of young females. He looks up then, finds me staring and shrugs as if he's the one who's embarrassed. And then, in that moment, I realize the reason he had looked familiar to me. He is Ren Sawyer, lead singer for Temporal. My drunken topple had landed me on the lap of a rock star.
4. Ren. The back of a limo is one of the loneliest places a person can be alone. I've never said as much to anyone because I know how it sounds. First-world problems and such. With the window up between me and the driver, I'm in a bubble. I can see the world outside, but people can't see me. I'm not a part of that world, which is as close a metaphor to my current life as I can probably get. I've long given up trying to convince Stuart that I would much rather grab a taxi than climb into a limousine, when the whole reason I take these trips by myself is to get away from the attention. What draws attention more than a limousine driver holding up a card with my name on it? All I want right now is a dark room and a bed where I can sleep for as long as my body will let me. I never sleep on flights because the truth is, I hate flying. For control freaks, flying is an adventure in letting go, accepting fate and the fact that your future is in someone else's hands. I've never been very good at either. My phone rings. I pull it from my shirt pocket, glance at the screen, and drop my head back against the seat. Gretchen. No doubt calling to make sure I haven't changed my mind about spending some time here alone. I know all I have to do is give the slightest encouragement, and she'll be over on the next plane. The fact that I do not want her to come says more about me than it does about her. She's nice, or as nice as an overindulged rich girl-turned-supermodel can possibly be. Of all people, I guess I should know what constant adoration can do to supersize a person's ego. It doesn't even seem fair to blame her. Guilt requires me to answer the call. Hey, I say.
Hey, she says back. You're there?
Yes, on the way to the hotel.
Did Stuart ignore you and get the limo anyway?
Stuart ignored me.
He wouldn't consider himself a good manager if he didn't. His heart is in the right place. He thinks you're safer that way. And I have to agree with him.
I start to murmur some sound of agreement, but I stop myself because I really don't want to. What I want is to disappear for a while, to not be recognized by anyone, walk through an airport, pick up my luggage, and disappear. If I could do that, really do that, I'm not sure I would come back. Smart guy that he is, Stuart knows this. It's not something we've ever talked about, but he knows it. That's why he keeps up the walls, the limousines, the five-star hotels, and leaking information on my whereabouts to reporters. He considers all of this part of his job, part of maintaining what is. And from his point of view, I get it. The illusion is held together with invisible threads. Pull one and the whole thing collapses from within.
Are you okay?
Gretchen asks. I hear the concern in her voice. I know if I ask her, she will say she loves me. Only I'm not sure exactly who it is she loves. The guy she thinks I am. The one who takes her to A-list parties. The one who sings in front of thousands of people. Songs he's begun to get a little tired of. I wonder if she could be in love with the me she's never had a chance to meet. I think I know the answer. And that's what makes what we have feel thin and insubstantial. Even as I find myself thinking this, I have to admit none of that is her fault. She can only know the guy I've shown her, the one who fits the image that's been created for me, the one I've worked so hard to make fit. Because after all, I'm the one who went after this dream. No one made me. I think of that old adage about the dog who chased the car every day until he finally caught it, and then there was nothing to chase anymore. If I had to name the place, I'd say that's where I am.
I want to come, Ren,
Gretchen says, breaking the silence between us.
Why won't you let me?
I just need a little time away, that's all.
But you won't say how long.
I really don't know how long, I say, because I really don't. Long enough for this feeling of despair to dissipate. Did I really just think despair? How pathetic is that? A guy who has everything he ever wanted, and more. Despair? But that's the word that seems to cover it. A panicky feeling of sorts that makes me wonder if I'm losing it altogether. I think about the concert in Charlotte 2 nights ago. The dread that swept through me right before I went on stage. And the sensation of choking that never left me for a single minute throughout the show. I don't know. The feeling might have started a year or so ago. Maybe a little longer. Growing incrementally with every performance until it became too large for me to ignore. I haven't told anyone. But after what happened during this last show, I realized that fairly soon I'm not going to have to. This time the panic attack didn't blow up until I left the stage. Without an encore, for the first time since Temporal hit the big league, I managed to convince Stuart and everyone else that it was a bug of some sort. That I'd gotten sick in the bathroom and already felt better. None of that had been the truth. I suspect if Stuart didn't already know it, he did when I told him yesterday morning that I was going away for a while. He had objected, strongly.
Ren, we've got tons of post-tour publicity scheduled. Can't you wait for a couple of weeks?
No, I say, my voice firm in a way that I'm not sure I've ever used with him. He picked up on it immediately, saying, All right, okay, whatever you need to do. It's been a long tour. You're probably exhausted. I didn't answer that, letting my silence indicate agreement. He didn't question me again. Instead, he booked the flight, made the hotel reservation in Rome, and told me to call him in a few days. I'm not sure how long silence has again taken over our conversation, when Gretchen breaks in with,
Ren, are you there?
Yes, I say. Look, I'll call you in a day or two.
I'll cancel my shoot in Barbados if you'll change your mind, she offers.
You go, I say. We'll talk when you get back, all right?
Okay, then,
she says, her reluctance clear.
Be safe.
You too, I say, and end the call. The limo windows are tinted, but I can still see the streets. We're passing the Colosseum ruins, a sight that never fails to unnerve me. Makes me think about the fact that this is where people once came for their entertainment. Most of it too horrible to contemplate. If I have begun to think that Temporal's performances feel a bit insipid, at least there's comfort in knowing that the entertainment we provide doesn't include watching people be torn to shreds by a starved wild animal. The limo pulls up in front of the hotel some 20 minutes later. I've stayed here several times before and know the drill. The driver tries to help me with my suitcase. I insist on taking it, handing him a 50 and thanking him for the ride. A man in a dark suit walks out to greet me and then leads me to a private elevator and up to my room. This, too, Stuart has arranged, and I have to admit I'm grateful for this part, if only because it assures me I won't be stopped. The man is discreet, opening my door and then handing me the key with a polite Italian-accented wish for a good stay. "Thank you," I say, step into the room and close the door behind me. With the click of the lock, something inside me screams a quiet relief. I am alone. Finally. No pretenses to maintain. No pretending to be anything other than what I am. A guy who has created a life for himself that he no longer deserves.
5. Lizzie. I have a 3-hour layover in Rome. I find a cafe and ply myself with 2 espressos in an effort to stay awake. I guess drunken sleep isn't the same as sober sleep, because I feel as if I didn't sleep at all. The megadose of caffeine helps, but it doesn't erase the yucky, fatigued feeling. I find myself wondering if Ren Sawyer slept on the plane. He's probably used to staying up most of the night with after-concert parties. An overnight flight would be lightweight to him. Every time his name pops into my head, my cheeks instantly ignite with embarrassment. It was bad enough to think that I had subjected myself to the mortification of a drunken topple onto a stranger. That was enough to last me several lifetimes, but add to that the now undeniable fact that the stranger had been the superstar my own daughter had lusted after throughout her high school years. Well, that put it into the realm of, what did I do to deserve that? Not that it would likely ever cross his mind again, but it would certainly cross mine. I force my attention to the book I've been trying to read on my iPad. Every other line or so, the words start to blur, and my intention of putting my mind on something else fails. Instead, I open my laptop, turn on the wireless, and find a hotspot to log on through. Since my phone doesn't have service, I fully expect a blistering email from Ty. And there they are. 3 of them. The subject line in capital letters. Call me now! ! I open the messages to find nothing other than the subject, and something about the demand has me exiting out of my account and slapping the laptop closed. At least I no longer need to wonder if he's angry. Which, if I let myself think about it, will send me right over the edge. Ty's decision not to follow through on this trip he had promised we would take together was his own choice. The fact that he had assumed I would do what I've always done, fall in line with his choices, well, that was his to live with. As for me, if I needed any further impetus to stay here for the next month, to not let guilt weaken my resolve and walk me over to the ticket counter for a reroute home, he has just given it to me. I am here. I am staying. If it kills me, I will enjoy myself.
6. Ty. You hope she's already starting to regret her rashness. She's barely ever traveled anywhere without you or Kylie. The Lizzie you know was never a chance taker. She'd always been the one to read aloud articles about Americans who had horrible disaster vacations while outside the country. There had been that cruise ship that hit a rock off the coast of Italy and capsized. She'd even made you and Kylie watch a documentary about the whole thing, and she'd vowed never again to get on a cruise ship. You finally give up on sleep at 5:30, get up and take a shower, then head to the kitchen to make coffee. Normally, Lizzie has it ready for you. After numerous edits over the years, she now makes it exactly as you like it. From coffee beans. Very hot, very strong. You don't add enough coffee, and the first cup is far weaker than you like. You ditch the whole pot and start over. You find yourself resenting her for putting you in this position. She should be here, making coffee the way she always does. It's not your job anyway. Your job is to get up and go to work, not in a state of frustration, but ready to meet the challenges of what are often very challenging days. You feel the heat of anger light your cheeks again, and suddenly you really want to hit something. Instead, you walk outside, get the newspaper, and bring it back to the kitchen table, where you sit with your mildly improved coffee. Just as you open the first section, your cell phone rings from its spot on the counter. You get up quickly, sure it will be her, asking you to get her on the next flight home. She made a mistake. She should have known better. But a glance at the screen shows Kylie's name and picture. You consider not answering. Explaining all of this to her right now seems like more than you can manage. But if you don't answer, she'll just call back. You swipe the screen and put on a bright voice. Hey, sweetheart, you're up early. How's everything in Charlottesville? Good. Are y'all in Rome? She asks, yawning. No, you say. At least, I'm not. She's silent for a moment as if she's not sure what to make of your answer. You're not? I wasn't able to go on a trip. A case needed my attention at the last minute. Oh, I know Mom must have been disappointed not to go. Yeah, you say. About that. She went alone. Mom? She says, expressing the same incredulity you felt on learning of it. No way. Way, I'm afraid, you say. I can't believe you let her do that. I didn't have a lot to say about it. You didn't know she was going? No. Silence stagnates on the line. You suddenly feel the need to break it, to lessen the implications of Lizzie making such a choice. I'm sure she'll be fine. She's wanted to do the trip for a long time. I know, but that doesn't sound like Mom. Can you go over and join her at some point? I'm not really sure, you say, trying to keep your voice even, unmarred by the anger still lighting a flare in your chest. Is she sticking with the original itinerary? I would assume so, you say, and then wish you could take that back. It sounds so spineless, so wimp-like. Dad, is everything all right between you two? Everything is fine. Silence again, while your daughter weighs whether to believe you or not. But you know she will, because you're her favorite. She always sides with you. I can't believe she wouldn't reschedule the trip so that you could go too. There, just as you'd thought, you have her sympathy. It's okay, honey, I've got plenty of work to keep me busy. All work and no play? You know they're practically the same to me. Yeah, I know. Well, call me if you want to come home for the weekend. You start to say that's a good idea. But then you picture the new associate, that smooth skin above the neckline of her sweater. Instead, you say, I suspect I'll be in the office most of Saturday and Sunday. Otherwise, I'd take you up on it. Are you sure? Yeah. Okay. I'll be checking on you. Thanks, honey. Once she clicks off, you stand for a moment, staring at the phone. Shouldn't you feel a little bit of guilt for deceiving your daughter? Yes. You wait for it to hit, but it doesn't. You stick the phone in your pocket, grab your briefcase, and head for the door.
7. Kylie. Kylie hangs up from the phone call with her dad, feeling as if she never saw that one coming. She's sitting on her bed, staring at the screen of her phone when Peyton, her roommate, opens the door and slinks into the room. "Dare I ask where you spent the night?" Kylie asks, looking at her with a raised eyebrow. "Probably better if you don't," Peyton says, flopping down on the twin bed beside her. "What did you do? Study all night?" Imagine that, this being college and all. Ooh, Kylie's snippy this morning. I like it. Shut up, she says, and swats Peyton's arm. Kylie smiles despite herself. Most of the time, she's irritated at Peyton. She's like a toddler who constantly gets into trouble, but has become expert at charming her way out of it. So what's the source? Your mom call? She asks, looking at the phone in Kylie's hand. No, Kylie says quickly, and then, because she feels a desperate need to talk about what had just happened, adds, My dad. Isn't he the one you get along with? Kylie shrugs. It's not that my mom and I don't get along. She just kind of smothers me. Isn't that her job? Maybe when I was 5. I'm not 5 anymore. In her defense, loving someone and wanting the best for them can cause overprotectiveness. It's a known fact. And all the side effects that go with it. There is that. Kylie hesitates and then says, My parents were supposed to take this great 20-year anniversary trip to Italy. My dad had work stuff, though, and couldn't go at the last minute. So my mom went without him. Peyton leans back, raises a finger. Score one for mom. And you think there's something wrong with that? Yeah, I do. She could have waited and gone another time. Peyton says. If he's anything like my dad, there won't be another time. My dad's not like that. He just takes his work seriously. So does mine, which means my mom spends a lot of time alone. I am so not going to marry a guy like that. Then he'll have to be independently wealthy to support your Starbucks habit. Peyton giggles. That'll be the least of his worries, she says, stretching out a leg to show off the Prada platform she'd worn out last night. You got that right, Kylie says. Is your mom in Italy now? I guess so. Why don't you call her if you're all worried? I'm not worried. More like pissed. Pourquoi? Because she shouldn't have done that to my dad. My guess is that's exactly what she should have done. Hey, whose side are you on anyway? Well, I've seen my mom after one of my dad's last-minute cancellations. She takes it pretty hard. Maybe your mom did, too. I don't think my parents are like yours. How so? Kylie shakes her head. I don't know. You know how, when you're a little kid, you think your parents love each other more than anything in the world? That nothing could ever change that? Yeah, I do. Somewhere along the way, I figured out that was all just a big fairy tale. Hey, Peyton says, putting her hand on Kylie's arm. I know what you need. What? Let's ditch classes today and go shopping. With your parents' credit card. That should make you feel better. You're crazy, Kylie says. But I'm right. Kylie doesn't bother to deny it.
8. Lizzie. What I absolutely love about Florence, the bells. The magnificent sound of church bells waking me in the morning. A heavy medieval gong, gong, gong that is as pleasant as it is beautiful. Music I would like to hear over and over again. As soon as the bells rouse me from sleep, I jump out of bed and open the glass pane doors so that I can hear them in their fullest glory. I think it would be wonderful to be woken this way every day of my life. The second thing I love about Florence, this room. This magnificent, high-ceiling room in the Hotel Savoy. Again, another piece of our anniversary splurge. The room is far more luxurious than anything I need. Nonetheless, I love it. I love, too, the fact that the doorbell rings at 7 on the dot, and a dark-haired Italian who looks like he must be a college student arrives with my tray of American coffee. It's a weakened version of their Italian espresso, but still strong for me. The taste is wonderful, rich and mellow on my tongue. A small basket of delectable pastries accompanies the coffee pot. They all but melt in my mouth. I pour myself a cup and sit on the terrace